I've never hidden the fact that my first career choice was stand-up comedy. However, I could never figure out what major in college I should sign up for to be a stand-up comic. And now looking back and hearing the stories of the work stand-ups need to do to make it, I really don't think I had the gumption for it. My second choice, since I knew early on that stand-up probably wouldn't pan out, was preaching. In many ways, they're the same thing. I tell stories, I make jokes, you laugh, maybe you cry a little, it works. And if you can't see this, but I literally put a smiley face in my notes. But because of all the schooling for ministry, I interact with comedy through a theological lens. And what I notice as I watch comics is that so do they. Or maybe they wouldn't call it that. And in all honesty, maybe I shouldn't either. But what I see through comedy is the ability to speak truth to power in a protected way. This is an old process. It's been going on for a long time, and it goes on today. It's been a staple of television since before Carson and continues on through Colbert, Oliver, and Larry Wilmore. A true comedian looks at the world and speaks honestly into it. I once did an entire service on Tig Notaro, who dealt with her cancer diagnosis the day it was given to her on stage during her comic routine. See, a good comedian approaches life with the idea that everything is funny and nothing is funny at the same time. Chris Gethard, in his HBO comedy special Career Suicide, begins by telling the audience, "Before I tell you anything else you need to know, I see a shrink. We're good." That's the first line of his special. And he mentions later on that he's actually known his shrink longer than his wife. I remember the first time I came across this special, I was looking for something to watch that would bring some cheap laughs and levity into my life. I heard the first line and immediately turned the station to watch repeats of Big Bang Theory. Because that day, I just couldn't handle where he was going. Later, I came back to that show. See, I tagged it in my head as, this is something I have to see. I kept putting it off, because even though I appreciated that comedy and tragedy are two sides of the same coin, sometimes I'd prefer my comedy plain hold the tragedy. Because it seems like this year and last, there has been enough tragedy. How am I supposed to handle life if my escape to comedy is riddled with depression? But then I come back to the truth of the matter. Comedy and tragedy are two sides of the same coin. He tells a story one day while listening to Morrissey. He was driving behind an older model truck. The truck puts on a turn signal and begins to change lanes. He speeds up to go around the truck on the inside, and the truck changes its mind. Knowing that he is now in the man's blind spot, he says to himself, "You should hit the brakes." And then he thinks, "No, don't, because this way it's just a car crash. In this way, your parents don't have to go around town being the parents of the kid who killed himself. Because we don't judge people when they die in car crashes, but we do judge people who die of suicide." Being a comedic writer, he brings that back to a laughable center, but does not change the tone or the seriousness of his statements. He says, "I think one of the things we've given ourselves permission to do," he goes on to say, he says, "I think it's one of those things we've given ourselves permission to do." And he goes on to say, "You know, it's a branding problem. The tagline of suicide, he says, sucks. The coward's way out. Suicide, he says, may mean many things, but it's not cowardly. Later, he talks about getting medication for the first time to help with his depression. He goes on and talks about his struggle taking medication for mental health because that is the one medication, he says, that when someone hears you take, they feel free to offer up their unsolicited opinions about it. When it comes to diseases, he says, no one in human history has ever said the words, "What's so wrong with your life that you need chemotherapy?" Or, "You're going to take insulin, but you're going to work yourself off it, right?" Gethard tells a very painful story comedically, and in doing so, does something very important. He normalizes it. He tells a story that says mental illness is just another illness, and any stigma attached is undeserved and unhelpful. As I watched him tell his story, I laughed and I cried and I wondered into the depths of my soul, where can I fit this into my sermon? But see, depression is not uncommon, which sounds like a double negative. And in English, when we use a double negative, it makes a positive. So I could say depression is common. According to the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, 6.7% of the population suffers from major depression. 18%, which is 40 million, suffer from anxiety disorders. And to keep that in mind of something else, you can compare it to 9.4% of Americans who suffer from diabetes. But that's just diagnosed Americans. We live in an ever-moving scale of mental health, each person varying to a different degree, and for some, that scale tips way further than it does in others. But it doesn't mean that we don't all go through it at some point in our life. My generation took pride in their depression, especially when it came to music. "I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real." Or, "When your day is long and the night is yours alone, and you're sure you've had too much, hang on. Do you have the time to listen to me whine about nothing and everything all at once? I am one of those melodramatic fools, neurotic to the bone, no doubt about it. Or, clearly I remember picking on the boy, seemed a harmless little..." "I love you, Slim. We could have been together. Think about it. You ruined it. I hope you can't sleep and you dream about it. And when you dream about it, I hope you can't sleep and you scream about it. I hope your conscience eats at you and you can't breathe without me." But see, that's not new. Human beings have been singing about depression for so long. "In the clearing stood a boxer, a fighter by his trade, and he carries the reminders of every glove he laid down." Da, 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 da. "Maybe then I'll fade away and not have to face the facts. It's not easy facing up when your whole world is black. Many friends come and go. You know there's a lot of feelings that I've left behind. And it's a lonely world, I know, when your friends are hard to find." And some of you may not know they removed the lyrics from the theme song to MASH. "Through early morning fog I see visions of the things that be, the pains that are withheld in me. I realize and I can see." And it goes on from there. But then we've sung of our depression for generations and generations. I remember when I was a chaplain at Methodist Healthcare in Memphis, Tennessee, I was called to the cardiac ICU and a man died. Sort of. They brought him back to life. Then he died again. The cycle continued. But the doctors knew he would never stabilize. His heart was not strong enough. I stood in the waiting room with his wife crying, surrounded by church members. The minister cuts me off, preaches shortly in that waiting room about the hope and belief in a God that can raise the dead, and the belief in a God who can heal even the worst of maladies. And the problem I have with that in that situation is that that patient didn't have a strong enough heart to keep beating, and maybe God can do miracles, like restoring death, but it didn't happen that day. And I'm afraid she left diminished because she lost her husband, and not only that, realized her faith was not strong enough to raise the dead. I don't know if religious people have approached spiritual pain and mental illness very well. I mean, I know there's some out there who really get it, but that's not what I heard that day. Because sometimes all we can say is, I'm sorry, but this is going to happen. And I want you to know that you are not alone. In his book, Why Do Christians Shoot Their Wounded? Dwight Carlson says, many Christians and prominent leaders view most, if not all, emotional problems as a direct result of sin and bad choices. Culture reasserts this issue and calls it a work ethic. People in poverty, people in emotional pain, it all has to do with the choices they've made. In the first chapter of 1 Samuel, we find a faithful woman named Hannah praying in the temple for a child because she could not get pregnant. She prayed so fervently and so emotionally that the priest Eli mistook her grief for something else, saying to her, "How long will you make yourself drunk? Put away your wine." And without going into a lot of depth, I can tell you that the book of Job goes very far out of its own way, so far that some would say condemns God himself to say that Job is an innocent man, that he did nothing to deserve his pain. So that when we read the poetry in the sinner, we are forced to embrace his spiritual pain as our own. And now my life ebbs away. Days of suffering grip me. Night pierces my bones. My gnawing pain never rests. In his great power, God becomes like clothing to me. He binds me like the neck of my garment. He throws me in the mud, and I am reduced to dust and ashes. I cry out to you, God, but you do not answer. I stand up, but you merely look at me. You turn on me ruthlessly. With the might of your hands, you attack me. You snatch me up and drive me from like the wind. You toss me about in the storm. I know you will bring me down to death, to the place appointed for all the living. See, Western faith, especially those derived from the Reformation, struggle with emotional and spiritual pain. It's like we're so dead set on centering a faith around a human spirit that can shape our own lives and world that we forget there are just some things we can't control. We can't control other people, and sometimes we can't control ourselves, and often we sure as hell can't control our biology. We find ourselves... So I've been approaching this series differently than I do most of my UU sermons. I'm preaching a biblical series for a simple reason. To confront the idea that pain and suffering are always related to sin. Because at some point, as a culture and as a nation, we took a wrong turn, especially theologically. We find ourselves in binaries that say, either all pain is our fault and controllable, or we accept our biology with pity and shame. It doesn't help that our healthcare system still doesn't like to accept that mental illness is actually an illness. The three synoptic gospels tell a story of Jesus confronting a demon named Legion. The man who suffered is forced to live in the tombs as if he's already dead. He was written off by a system, assumed there was nothing that could be done for him, so he was locked away and forgotten. As UUs, we've begun to see those basic binaries are breaking down. Not because something is wrong with culture and not because humanity is changing, but because we have a faith that prides itself on the idea that revelation is not sealed and we can continue to grow and learn. Our faith is open to understanding gender beyond binary, mental illness beyond binary, economics beyond binary, and pain beyond binaries. We can do this because we know that as a people, we have not arrived at our final evolution. We are always in search for truth, with the acknowledgement that we walk this path in our own speed. But we're not there yet. And I still believe it's important to take our source material and understand it so that we can address misunderstandings at a cultural level. Not even the Bible is black and white on anything. And if we can know that, then we can help others who are not on the same point in the journey that we are. Chris Gethard tells a story during his one-man show about returning from a bad show one night, and he has to pull over on the side of the road. And the story from the beginning, where he says he's the one who told the story in the beginning about how he tried to commit suicide by traffic, and it was about to happen again. He pulls over. He explains that he was sweating and feeling pins and needles, and he calls his ex-girlfriend and he says, "It's happening again." She says, "This is what you're going to do. You're going to drive directly to your house, wake up your mom and tell her that you're suicidal, or in the morning I'm going to call her and ask." And he says, "She took the choice away from me," which made him very angry. But in hindsight, he acknowledged that saved his life. He said to her, "That's not fair." She said, "Not fair? You're still in calling me about this. You dumped me 18 months ago." Expletive deleted. He walks into his mother's bedroom, and when he tells the story, says this amazingly heartbreaking thing: "I reach out to her and realize this is the last time she ever gets to think she has a normal kid." And I personally can't help listening to this, thinking that the issue we have is this screwed up idea that there is normal. There is no normal. In 5 years of chaplain work, I never ran into a normal family. In 15 years of ministry, I'm still looking for normal people. I remember sitting with my therapist when I was 22 years old, and I said, "My God, I just want to be normal." And if you only remember one thing about this sermon, I want you to walk away knowing you are not normal. There is no normal. I printed a copy of the DSM-5's Diagnosis of Depression that I'm not going to read to you. Because I realized I'm not a diagnostician, I'm not a therapist, and I'm not a counselor. So I'm not going to read that. But what I am going to do is this. I'm going to ask you to take a chance on me here. And raise your hand if you've ever talked to a counselor, taken medication, or have been diagnosed with something. And keep them up. Yes. And I need to ask a favor for those of the people with your hands up. Don't be afraid of your story. Because if we can say therapy is worth it without shame, which I know is a process, we normalize the idea that we are all broken. Neither more or less, just different. You can put your hands down. Thank you. And for those of you who haven't asked for help, feel free to ask. I can't promise that I can fix it. I can't even promise that I can help you. But there's a good chance I can point you to someone who can. Because you are not normal. Because the fact is, if you're normal, then there's something really wrong with me.